Okay, good afternoon. Since the doors are closed, I'm going to assume that everybody who wants to be in the room is in the room. I have the pleasure of reintroducing myself to talk to you very briefly about some additional outcomes of the PEER project. These should be sort of taken in a certain spirit. The point here is that you've heard today about the various ways in which the PEER project partners collaborated to make the infrastructure possible and then to conduct the research, and you've heard about the research results. And I'm now going, so to speak, back to the means whereby the PEER project was conducted to say that there were some additional outcomes, and some of these are interesting and or noteworthy in a particular sense, and these are the ones I want to briefly introduce you to. Now, here you, so to speak, have a list. There's a set of smaller, 1, 2, 3. These are actually stuff you've heard about in the morning. So you've heard about the peer depot workflow. You've heard about the new modes of automated content management and distribution, and about the innovations that went on in the peer project, the peer depot in particular, in the way the publisher data was ingested and went out to the repositories. So I'm not going to... I'd just like to remind you that these were also... important outcomes, but now I'm going to concentrate on what is here listed as 4, 5, 6, and 7. So I want to talk briefly about the way in which the peer project and the length of time that has involved has given publishers a chance to re-examine their policies vis-a-vis green open access, or maybe vis-a-vis open access more generally. There's an opportunity, of course, for the repositories to reflect on the way the peer project worked, in particular the centralized deposit model and then the transfer process from the depot to the repository. There's a bit more I'm going to talk about author deposit behavior. You've already heard the number of 170 authors depositing, with over 11,800 being invited, so this small number and what might be said about this. And then I'm going to also finally briefly go back to the user experience. You will remember a few minutes ago when Jenny Fry was talking about the behavioral research, they tried to implement a user survey, a repository exit survey that was designed at people actually using the repositories, and they only got 34 responses, even though we worked very hard. We then had another look at this, and the peer project partners, they don't just have the peer collection, they have wider repositories. And then there was a decision was made to try again and see if the wider collection was made available for the exit survey, we'd have more responses. And there's a bit we can talk about. So, onwards. Now, what you need to keep at the back of your mind when you see this slide is, so to speak, the publishers that participated in the peer project. You've seen the list before, going all the way from BMJ down to Wiley, so significant number of the large STM publishers. And what we did was that towards the end of the project, we went back to them and said, well, how have your views changed? What was your experience with the peer project? And we sort of interviewed them in an iterative process to get some authorized statements from how publishers see their open access policies at the moment. These will become available after the conference, and this and the following slides simply summarize what can comes out of those statements. So the first point to note really is that at this point in time, all publishers emphasize their OA publishing ventures as well as their hybrid offers. You will also be aware that STM has recently made a statement with regard to open access publishing. So there's a sizable shift there, and this comes out from the statement. As regards the peer project, there was the collaboration overall was very much appreciated. And then there's a difference. So there's some variation about publishers, how significant their own investments were in terms of being peer depot compliant, of making it work. For some, it wasn't. For some, it was. It depends on internal workflows. There isn't a rough and ready way to characterize when and where. It's rather very individual. And then the next point is that publishers There's also some variation with regard to their green open access policies. So some publishers have indicated that by and large they don't have an issue with this, and the authors are free to do this, particularly in the self-archiving version. But it's a different matter when it comes to any form of green open access scenario that requires publisher collaboration. And of course, we have this in the peer project. You'll be aware, yeah, the 170 author deposits versus the 19,000 manuscripts that have come from the publishers. And if you were to think about any sort of large-scale green open access scenarios, and there are some out in the world where there are mandates, so to speak, that back this and that include publisher collaboration, then the thing, it looks different. And there's a feeling that this would be a game changer and would need to be dealt with differently. So if publishers are part of a green OA scenario, and it has to be added, not all publishers can really imagine this, then their expertise costs and opportunity costs need to be recognized. Then there's an additional point that revolves around usage. So we've heard about the usage research, and we've seen some graphs that indicate that there is some usage at the repositories relative to the publishers. We've also seen results that indicate that, at least in the peer project, the visibility that the repositories create increases traffic at publisher websites. However, there is, of course, a movement afoot. Some people are interested in using a changing pricing mechanisms or amending pricing mechanisms so that usage becomes more important. And then, of course, the proliferation of versions of manuscripts and so on becomes problematic because you can't count usage, really. You don't know where it's happening. And the final point here is then, goes back to the first one I made. Since open access publishing is growing and all publishers now have open access offers, open access journals or hybrid publishing offers, and they invest in archiving, then the question is whether the costs of Green OA, the additional costs, so to speak, that generates are justified at all. So, you now must imagine that I've had a publisher cap on my head, and now I need to take it off, and I need to put a repository cap on my head.
Very different, though.
I look at that entirely different. Yeah, I'm an entirely different person because now I need to speak about the repository opinion. Okay. And if you don't like it, I understand that the messenger eventually gets shot. Yeah, but so I'm talking about the repository opinion here, and the repository opinion relates to what's happened in the peer process as a potential way of doing it. So you remember from this morning that there was a particular centralized deposit model that the peer project used. So we can talk about the systematic provision of a large number of manuscripts by publishers. And then there are, so to speak, listed here some of the beneficial features or beneficial consequences that this had in terms of automated deposits and what's available. And then it is the case that among those repositories that participated, some repositories consider this scenario, systematic deposit by publishers, as a desirable part of future green open access policies. It was about the systematic deposit of stage two manuscripts, and there was you heard about how these manuscripts arrived in heterogeneous formats, and so there's this question of whether if you had a centralized and such deposit procedure, there's a way in which you can standardize this thing more so that, in effect, it becomes more efficient to do it. The second part was that once the stuff had all been processed in the peer depot, it went through a transfer process, the SOLD protocol, out to the repositories. So peer generated an efficient and automated transfer process, and this simply means that at the end of the day, through the SOLD protocol, you can handle a very large number of manuscripts. So in essence, if you so want, the peer depot developed an almost unlimited capacity, once it's an automated workflow, to process any number of manuscripts per day. And here again, some of the repositories consider this as a desirable part of future Green OA scenarios. And then the central processing unit itself that made it available with its characteristics as a clearinghouse, as filtering, so to speak, the appropriate content, and maybe not just filtering EU authors, but also filtering, so to speak, what is actually a research article and what is other material from journals, matching the manuscripts with the metadata, managing the embargo, and so on. So certain kinds of service tasks that were performed centrally. Again, it's the case that some repositories consider this a desirable part of future OA policies. Okay, I change hat again. This time from speaking for the repositories to speaking a bit on behalf of the peer project and the particular issue of author self-archiving. Now, there's first something to be said about the way the peer project did it, just to make this, so to speak, very clear, and then a little bit about talking about what could be done with this issue of author deposit. So what I'm trying to show you with this slide is that the peer project actually took great care to make self-archiving convenient. We couldn't know whether it was likely or unlikely, but we could sort of speak entice it and make it convenient. So you have step one, the publisher raised author awareness upon submission. Step two, the publisher invites the author upon acceptance. So two reminders. There was a single deposit interface with a help desk. In case you got stuck, there was somebody there to help you. Centralized management. So there weren't very many routes, just one route. And it was, so to speak, convenient also in the sense that the deposit was prompted when the manuscript was fresh. So you must imagine you get an acceptance email. You are being published. At the same time, you get the invitation to deposit. So this is really the moment when you have everything in hand. If at all, if there is any moment in time, yeah, when an author would have a stage two version ready at hand and could start, that's the moment. Upon acceptance, they got this invitation. Because the invitation came from the publisher, there can't have really been any concerns about permissions and copyright and so on. So in principle, at that very moment, you could deposit with confidence. And since the invitation actually told you what to do and where to do it, you could have promptly done it. Okay, so if at all, we facilitated this. Nevertheless, we got only 170. I think it's worth thinking about a little bit further what this means for self-archiving scenarios. But nevertheless, the peer project then felt, even though we had only a very small number, can we say anything about those people who did deposit? And that's what I would like you to look at here. This chart was developed with the help of colleagues from Elsevier, who for a particular year tried to identify all authors that got an invitation in the peer project to deposit and find out which ones had deposited actually using their Scopus database, and then came back with these numbers by trying to understand in that sample whether there was anything worthwhile, whether there was any difference noticeable. Now, caveat. N is 118. Now, any old way you do this, for 1 year, this isn't a result that you can publish. It's just something we did, so to speak, as an exercise. I think that's how you take it. Within that exercise, we found that younger authors, junior authors, were more likely to accept the invitation to deposit than those who didn't. And then we found that those who deposited were those, so to speak, early stage career who were also, further indications, had overall published less and were less frequently cited. But it isn't the result. It is only perhaps interesting in the sense that sometimes when one talks about open access, there has been the idea around that there's some sort of self-selection going on so that authors would deposit their better articles or whatever, which would indicate that maybe it'd be more senior authors or whatever. But we have, for this particular cohort, we can show it's junior researchers that are more likely to accept the invitation to deposit. The point I would maybe like to raise with everybody in the room is one of the things that struck me is that author deposit is so badly understood. I mean, there are a lot of assumptions around, but we know actually relatively little what happens. Now, we tried this. It strikes me that when we look at author submissions, there are a lot of people who are very concerned with author submissions. So Publishers, of course, want to know which authors submit, how many, what the rejection rate is. Journal editors are always concerned about the authors and where to submit. Institutions who have researchers are concerned about where their authors submit. They have various policies and encourage this and that and the other. Research funders are, you know, so there's a lot of data and concern and so on around author submission, and there are people who have data and will try and do something with it. It strikes me that when it comes to author deposit, we don't know anything really. And it also strikes me with regard to some of the issues that came up today when we talk author deposit, you needn't just think green open access. There was a mention today of data deposit. Similar issue. So the point I want to make here is we had something, we tried to look at it. I think it merits further examination, and those who are concerned with author deposit in any kind of way might want to take away from this the idea that it could be useful to investigate further. Okay, I move on again, this time to the user experience, so the other side. These are the people who use the repositories in this case. I already mentioned that the first round, unfortunately, we only got 34 responses. Then we tried to run it again, and after some maneuvering, institutions participating agreed to implement the survey, not just on the peer content, but on the repository more widely. But here again, health warning. We got 299 responses over 3 to 4 months. It's not a lot. It's simply too little. We have 226 responses that come from HAL and HAL INRIA. This is not the peer content hosted by HAL or HAL INRIA. This is the repository overall. So basically, the users of one particular repository are our respondents. This means it's not representative. You can't draw any further conclusions, really, from this. But again, it strikes me that in terms of user behavior at repositories and actual users, people who are there, so to speak, we perhaps simply don't know enough. So there's a way in which we, on the basis of the limited, on the basis of the data that we had with all its limitations, we try to look at a series of issues. So one of the things that came out was that peer users were often new to repositories. This correlates with the idea that they came in through search engines, yeah, and that they were looking for something and then they found it in peer repositories. Whereas given the sample, the users of HAL, the French repository, are more frequent users of repositories. And then this is sort of confirmed by the issue of whether people went directly to the repository or they went through somewhere else, and you can see again that peer users usually arrived through a different route. This is similar to the stuff you've seen for the behavioral research. So what were they looking for? A specific article. And you can again see here that peer users, so to speak, they were new. They came in through a search engine. They were more likely to look for something specific. And you see on the other slide, so to speak, correlating to that, that current awareness for users of the peer collection within those repositories wasn't such a big issue. Whereas we can surmise that for regular visitors of repositories, this might be more the case. Then did you find what you were looking for, and were you satisfied with what you found? You can see that on the whole, peer users reasonably found something they were looking for. Peer users found something similar, the stage 2 version to maybe the version of record they were looking for. Overall, users were satisfied. Maybe regular users of repositories who know what to expect are more satisfied, just simply because they have more experience with what they're doing. Okay, and the summary of what we've got, again, with the proviso, it's not representative. You can't extrapolate from this. But from what we found, the peer content is more likely to be accessed via a search engine than by visiting a repository. For many peer users, the experience was new. Peer users were usually looking for something specific rather than browsing. And more or less, half of them found something useful or more or less what they were looking for, something they could work with, even though there were these uncertainties over exactly what version they had in their hands. Overall, those who were users of the repository, maybe unsurprisingly, would use a repository again. So these are four additional outcomes from the peer project, saying something about where the publishers are at the moment, where the repositories that participated in the peer project are, indicating that author deposit behavior would be worth further investigation, and also probably the user experience would be worth further investigation. It also follows on from some of the stuff you've heard today in terms of usage and behavioral research, that we know some things, but other things we don't know, and it might be worthwhile to continue. Okay, I'm finished.
Thank you.